roughly the outlying areas of the Roman Empire back in that day before it fell in 476. What happened sometime early in the 300s AD is that the Mongols and the Huns from up there came around from like Russia, the Caucasus Mountains, and came across the top, the Caspian, of the top of the Caspian Sea, and started driving these other tribes, you know, basically westward. And one comes down and crosses over the Strait of Gibraltar and camps here and wreaks all kinds of havoc. But this is the barbarian invasions. The Huns are Oriental. The Mongols and the Huns are Oriental. The rest of these we consider Germanic or Teutonic tribes. I know I covered some of this last time, but just to go through it real quick again. What we think happened, we think that the Goths originated up in Sweden, way up on top. And then they came down, and there were some of them that broke off and became other Germanic tribes. But they came down to this area, and then they broke into Eastern Goths and Western Goths. So Ostrogoths are Eastern Goths. They're further over the top of the Black Sea. The Visigoths are the Western Goths, the Western Goths, and they raided all through Europe for, we'll talk more about that in a second, but with everybody being driven westward, the Jutes, the Saxons, the Angles crossed the North Sea and went over into England, and what we now know as England, Angleland. Most of us here, many of us here are Anglo-Saxons, and so these would be your progenitors. Another of the Teutonic tribes were the Vandals, who we'll meet again in a second. They crossed over the Strait of Gibraltar, went over to Carthage, North Africa, and from there they raided, they messed up Origen's city in Alexandria, Egypt. This is Carthage. So they kind of ruled for about 100 years in North Africa, and they took over for the Roman Empire there after the Roman Empire got busted, and they were much more amenable to Christians than the Roman Empire. But the Franks, the Lombards, the Burgundians became what we now know as French. So the French are Franks, and so that's what we got. So the historians view the invasions of the barbarians from 370 or so onward as this big challenge that the Roman Catholic Church helped to save the continent of Europe over. They're just horrified that these horrible barbarians would come in and sack Rome and mess up, you know, God's holy city and stuff. They all trumpet the glorious victory that many of the barbarians were converted to Roman Catholicism. And so in this way, the popes helped to save Europe. And the truth of the matter is, that's not how it was. The truth of the matter is that in all likelihood, the barbarian invasions were God's judgment on a empire that was ruled by heathen and pagans, and Christianity had become this paganized religion, so God judged them for it. That was repeated, by the way, a few hundred years later when the Lord raised up a guy named Muhammad, and pretty soon Muhammad had marched into the Middle East. This is the 600 and 700s AD. So this happens a couple of hundred years, 300 years after this, but they took over, you know, all of Israel. All of this became Muslim. The Muslims marched and crossed over, finally were defeated here in Tours before they got driven back, but the Muslims were marching in a pincer movement. They were moving this way and also moving this way, and they were going to take over Europe if somebody hadn't stopped them. But that's kind of what the barbarians did a few hundred years earlier. By the way, the barbarians were very often, like I said, less barbaric than the Romans were. there were Christians that flourished under the barbarians, while under the Roman Catholics they were deprived of their churches and hunted down and killed. We'll see more about that soon. The result of all this was that the conversion of the barbarians to Roman Catholicism was usually just kind of a mutual exploitation, where they make a compromise and the Roman Catholic monk or missionary or pontiff, the Pope, went to the barbarians and bought them off, and usually the barbarians accepted a baptism that made them Catholics. But it's just heathen converting heathen to other kinds of heathen. It's not a real conversion. It's certainly not real Christianity. We'll see that in a second. But it's also true that what they did do in that regard, where the barbarians became, Catholics, is it just paganized Christianity all the more from what it already was paganized. It just got worse and worse. All the barbarians brought all their relics and all their gods into the game, and that was perfectly fine. Folks, that's what's wrong in Haiti right now, is that the Roman Catholicism has embraced effectively the witchcraft and all of Haiti. It happened over and over again. It happened in Mexico. It happened in the Philippines. That's why the Roman Catholic Church is called the Great Whore in Revelation 17 and 18. It's just true. It's history. Now, so you kind of saw where how the barbarians ran, and they, like I said, they were driven from the east by the Mongols and the Huns, and the rest of those tribes are basically Teutonic or Germanic tribes that were then driven in front. They crossed over the North Sea or crossed over, found new ground in modern-day Europe. Many Europeans today, because the Huns did drive all the way here. There was multiple wars, multiple battles. The Huns ruled a great deal of Europe through quite a bit of time, and they say today that many, many Germans are genealogically Huns. Like I said, the French are effectively Franks, Lombards, and Burgundians. And, of course, a lot of this is now Muslimized, so the Vandals who led that kind of got driven out, but they had great effect while they were there. See where I want to pick up here. So the barbarians began threatening the outlying sectors of the Roman Empire in the 300s. In 378, Visigothic king came down here and defeated the emperor of Constantinople. That's the Roman emperor. He defeated, his name was Valens, and he defeated him and killed him. Just 3 or 4 years later, he has raided Constantinople, one of the great cities of that time frame. He had marched down into Greece, sacked cities. Then 10 years later, they were over in Italy, and he sacked Rome. Eventually, the Visigoths moved along these coasts, and where they wound up was Spain and Portugal. So the Spanish, true Spanish today, and the Portuguese are largely Visigothic. So that's kind of how all that stuff came to pass. The Vandals tore through Spain, crossed the Strait of Gibraltar, marched as far as Carthage, went ahead over to Alexandria, where Origen had his school, and they sacked that town. But mainly they kind of centered themselves here in Carthage, and by 455 they had crossed the Med and sacked Rome as well. Rome got sacked several times. I wanted to read you what it says, though, about the Vandals. The invasion of Vandals in 428 relieved... Okay, remember the Donatists? The good guys in North Africa, right? Donatists? The invasion of the Vandals in 428 relieved the oppressed Donatists in North Africa from the scourge of the licentious bishops of the Roman Catholic Church and the cruel courts. So the Roman Catholics have driven the Donatists out. They've killed their pastors and ministers. They've driven the people from the villages, and so they're just barely surviving. The Vandals entered Africa from Spain, and many who followed the army were protected by them in full liberty. These were old, you know, these were old Teutonic tribes, Goths and Gothmen. The Vandals, as other German tribes, had no king, no priest, and so were the avowed friends of liberty. The Donatist situation was ameliorated under the new Vandal dynasty, though they never returned to their former strength. For 100 years, North Africa was governed by a people called barbarians, yet their conduct was milder towards the followers of the Lamb and those of Christian interest than the Catholics had ever been. During this period, the Vandals allowed the Donatists to enjoy the sweets of civil and religious freedom. But when the empire of the Vandals was finally overturned scores of years later, the privileges of religious freedom ceased again for the Donatists, and they kind of disappeared from the scene. So it's just, again, interesting that, you know, somebody considered a barbarian. What do you think when you think about somebody that's a barbarian? You think they have a bone through their nose and they're eating somebody's liver raw, you know, that kind of thing. Turns out they were a lot more, you know, merciful than the Roman Catholics who were trying to destroy them. So you need to think about that. The Huns, like I said, there's more than one wave of this. I mean, it's not like these guys moved from there to there and just stayed there. It was all, you know, because there was wars all along. But the Huns, like I said, came on in and they battled other tribes. But they ruled much of Europe through a great deal of time. On one particular instance, the Huns came into Pope Leo. The Huns were finally defeated at Chalon, France, which is somewhere right around here. They were finally driven back. And being driven back, they marched this way. And Attila the Hun is actually they're in their charge. He's their leader, their general, their king. So they march on a Rome and are going to sack Rome. And I wanted to just read you a little bit of what happened there. This is how barbarians were converted by Catholics. Find the place to start here. There had been another terrible invasion of France in 451 by the Huns under Attila, who came clear through Italy in 452 to sack Rome, but was bought off at the last minute by Pope Leo I. Now, Pope Leo I is the guy that I've told you, we haven't studied him yet, he's the guy that I told you was the first real Catholic pope. This sudden deliverance from the heretical Arians. Now, remember, you just have to remember that the Council of Nicaea pronounced anybody that believed like Arius, you know, an Arian. And from that point on, anybody that didn't agree with the Catholic for about 300 years was just an Arian. You know, it didn't matter. It's like, you know, you're a Ruckmanite. And that's supposed to drive you, you know, under the couch, that kind of deal. But it's just name calling. But this sudden deliverance from the Arians, the Huns, on the part of the Bishop of Rome raised his stock so high that henceforth he was called the King of Rome. It's Leo I, the first real pope. He's the King of Rome, they said. The pagan Catholic historians call Leo I, the first, modestly, the Pope of Salvation. In view of this sudden elevation of a Bible-denying apostate who was in favor of kings killing anti-Catholic subjects, what could have taken place when Leo met with Attila the Hun? Well, what happened was that Leo I shelled out. He paid protection money to get rid of Attila, and he had plenty with him for when he went to the Mincio River to meet Attila the Hun. He had crosses of gold and gold monstrances, royal banners, and probably enough cash to finance a mafia. But the encounter is of tremendous theological import, for it shows that although Pope Leo I did not believe in killing Huns, even if they were Arians, as they call them, he did believe in killing heretics that were real, genuine Christians. Evidently, the deciding factor in determining which Arians to kill was the size of the armies that followed them. So anyway, Pope Leo supposedly saved Rome, and so he's a big hero. Now, there were some genuine folks that got saved. For instance, I didn't write him down. This would have been back in the 300s. But a guy named Ulfilas, converted Goths. Ulfilas was a preacher, got saved, and he's ministering to the Goths. Now the Goths don't have a written language. So Ulfilas has to figure out an alphabet for the language, then teach the Goths to read their own language, then give them a Bible so he could convert them. So it's not like he's a smart guy or anything. But he evangelized the Goths and got a bunch of them saved. Another guy you'll find, St. Patrick, came in at this time. St. Patrick was not an Irishman. He was a Scotchman that evangelized the Irish. And also another guy named Columba evangelized the Scots. And, you know, with these guys doing that, and a lot of these guys were street preachers and got folks genuinely saved, got many, 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 many barbarians saved. Not like the Catholics got them saved. Many other Catholic and Bible-believing Christian missionary efforts followed these well past the year 500 and really affected Europe a lot. So now we want to break off and talk about some personages. All these guys we're going to talk about tonight are bad guys. Like I said, this church history course was about kind of, I wanted to know who the good guys were versus the bad guys and where the good guys were. And so that's why we're talking about the Novatians, the Donatists, the Montanists, the Waldensians, and so on. Okay, who we're talking about tonight, or I'm sorry, but these are all bad guys. We'll get to good guys later. You got to hear the bad before you get your dessert. Anyway. Okay, these guys are known as the post-Nicene Fathers. The Nicene Council was in 325. So the anti-Nicene Fathers were, that was Origen and those guys before that. The post-Nicene Fathers are after 325. First one we'll look at is a guy named Ambrose, who was a bad guy. He was born in a prominent, wealthy Roman family. He trained in law and as a politician, was made the imperial governor of Milan, Italy. Soon after arriving in Milan as a governor, the bishop died and the people started disputing about who the bishop should be. There wound up being a riot because they couldn't decide, so they were fighting and throwing rocks and stuff. Ambrose, as governor, shows up to try to break up the riot, and there was heard a child's voice, the story goes, a child's voice that says, "Let Ambrose be bishop." And so they did. Now, the guy's not a Christian. He's never been baptized. He has no Bible training. He doesn't even have really religion. But they let him be the bishop of Milan. And so he became bishop of Milan, got baptized after he got consecrated as bishop. he sold his estates and took up, remember that word, some of you maybe not here for it yet, ascetic, We're talking about monks here. We're talking about living on beans and rice and going to a cave and taking off your clothes and running around in a desert naked for about 6 years, that kind of stuff. Okay, that's an ascetic practice. It's being hard on the flesh. That's what a monk does. We studied monks here recently, the monastics. Well, he took up ascetic practices, became a monk. He believed that unbaptized infants who died were lost. Now, just to make sure we're clear, is that true? Go ahead and get your Bible for a second. Let's just make sure we're on the same page with this, in case you worry about what happens with kids. Amen. Look in Romans chapter 4. Romans 4. And these are in greater context, but just let me just hit about three verses here real fast. You'll notice down in verse 15, because the law worketh wrath, for where no law is, there is no transgression. Okay, 4:15, right? Okay, so where no law is, there's no transgression. A child is innocent up to a certain age. Nobody knows the magic age. It probably differs from kid to kid, right? But at 2 years old, a kid doesn't know he's sinning against God. Okay? And so he comes to an age of maturity where he is capable of understanding that his sins are not just against mama and papa, but they're also against God. Okay, when he becomes conscientious of that law, then at that juncture, that where there is no law, there's no transgression. At that juncture, he's a sinner, and he knows he's transgressing. By conscience, Romans 2, he knows he's transgressing, right? Look in chapter 5, Romans chapter 5, and go down to verse 13. This adds a little color to it than the last one really does. But 5:13. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law. Now, Romans, like I said, Romans chapter 2, go read it carefully, and you'll find that a Gentile is under law in the sense that he has a basic understanding that, you know, murder's wrong, that stealing's wrong, etc., etc. And so by conscience, men know that, and God counts that for them. He will judge them on that basis, right? Now, the one last thing that's really important, look in Romans chapter 7. Romans chapter 7, and go down to verse 9. This gives you some color. Here's Paul. He says this, "For I was alive without the law once." Okay, when was Paul alive without the law? He was born a Jew, and he was always a Jew, right? So it must be his childhood before he understood the law. So he said, "I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died." So if I understand it right, you weren't born dead in trespasses and sins. Now, you were born with a fallen nature, but you weren't born dead. There came a day that you were became conscious that sin was sin, and when you sinned after that, you died spiritually. "You hath he quickened who were dead in trespasses and sins," right? And so there's some age, it's not necessarily a number, there's a level of maturity somewhere where a kid that's 5, 6, 7, 8 years old comes to a realization that what's wrong in his heart and what's wrong in his actions is against God. His conscience strikes him, and when he sins in that state, he falls. He becomes a sinner like Adam. So he's alive spiritually before that, although he's a fallen creature. Nevertheless, now his sins are counted against him. Okay, so an infant who is 6 weeks old has no capability of understanding that. So you baptizing a kid when he's 6 weeks old is an act of futility, right? And so that's what's going on here. So Ambrose was one of the first ones that believed that unbaptized infants who died were lost. His method of Bible study was allegorical. Okay, now that comes from guess where? Origins territory, right? Up here is Antioch of Syria, which is basically our line. Those were basically Bible believers. Down here in Alexandria, Egypt, where Origen did his work for all those years, then their theology went south really bad. And they're primarily allegorizers because they're trying to intermingle philosophy with Bible doctrine. When you intermingle philosophy with Bible doctrine, you come up with a monster. You come up with a mess, and you can't leave the Bible saying what it says. So you have to change it. Where the Bible says hell, it has to mean something else. It has to mean the grave or something else, but it can't mean hell because that would be hot. And when it says any various number of things, it can't just mean that. And so that's called allegorizing. You'll find a lot of that still goes on today. He was partially responsible for a guy later, Augustine, who's a Catholic quote-unquote hero, one of the Catholic superstars. He was basically responsible for Augustine's conversion, if he even was really converted. We'll talk about him later. After Ambrose's death and funeral, there were some people that were baptized where his body had lain. And when they got baptized there, they said, saw a vision of Ambrose sitting on his magisterial throne with a star on top of his head. And I bet that really happened. What do you bet? So that's Ambrose. He said he was said to have wrought many miracles after his death. I bet that really happened too. Next guy to mention is not a major player. Cyril of Jerusalem. There's two Cyrils back to back. One's from Jerusalem, one's from Alexandria. Cyril of Jerusalem was elected bishop in Jerusalem after 350. He was deeply involved in the Arian controversy at the Council of Nicaea, and he believed in exorcism at baptism. So one of the things you got when you got baptized as a baby, or for that matter as an adult, is that you were exorcised of your devils. And everything was supposed to be great after that. But he taught that. He taught that communion was a mystical and vital union of believers with Christ. He came really near the transubstantiation position, which is that when the priest says the magic words, the bread turns into the flesh of Christ. Okay, that's called witchcraft. And Cyril was one of the first ones to kind of promote that without calling it transubstantiation. In 351, he saw, and remember, he's in Jerusalem, he sees a giant luminous cross in the sky extending from Golgotha to the Mount of Olives. I bet that happened too. He said, if anyone receive not baptism, he cannot be saved. He's talking about water baptism. The next guy is Cyril of Alexandria. Does anything good come out of Alexandria? And the answer is no. He became the patriarch of Alexandria in 412. He was violent, arrogant, vengeful. Immediately upon entering office, he closed all the Donatist churches and seized their property. So his first move is to shut down the Donatists who were Bible believers like us. In 415, he fell on the synagogues of the Jews that were in his territory with an armed force, killed many of them, drove out many more. The rest of the property he left to the remaining to looters. So a real, not only anti-Christian, but brethren, what you find throughout Catholic history is also anti-Semitic. He's not just shutting down Donatists. He's shutting down the Jews. He's shutting down the synagogues. When the imperial governor protested of Cyril's, having done that to the synagogues, Cyril gathers 500 monks around him as a security force to guard himself. And when the monks then publicly insulted the governor, one of them threw a rock at the governor and hit the governor. And so the governor had him killed. And after the governor had one of Cyril's monks killed, Cyril promptly had the monk buried and proclaimed him a holy martyr. So it's all a political game. He lied, cheated, and fabricated various issues. We looked at Nestorianism last time, and I said that Nestorius probably was a good guy from what we can gather, but he had words put in his mouth by his enemies, and Cyril was one of those enemies. Cyril was also allegorical, like a lot of others. We'll see more about that in a second. He was also a Mariolater. So what you find in this day and age is all these guys that were bad guys, they were coming around to the Mariolatry position, the position that she was the queen of heaven. They were all saying that unless a baby gets baptized, it's going to hell, et cetera, et cetera. That's a great moneymaker for the Catholic Church. Okay, the next guy, his actual name is Sophonius Eusebius Hieronymus. But we know him as Jerome. Prefer him as Jerome. Okay, he is one of the Catholic Church's heroes. He is the greatest of the Latin fathers. He was born in Italy, Dalmatia, Italy, to wealthy parents. He was educated in Rome under some, basically philosophers. And he often visited the subterranean graves of martyrs on Sunday. So he'd go down and hang out with dead people in graveyards on Sundays. He was finally baptized by the Pope in 360. He claimed that Christ appeared to him and healed him of a severe illness. I bet that happened. He became a monk because he was preoccupied with something that a lot of young men are preoccupied with these days. Only it was back in that day. He was preoccupied with sex. And so he drove himself into celibacy, became a rabid proponent for monasticism. He was finally made secretary under Pope Damasius in 382. So when that happened, Pope Damasius gave him the permission to begin revising the old Latin Bible. Now remember, the Waldensian Bible, the Atala, the old Latin, came into being like 157 AD or something like that. So it's one of the oldest Bibles there is. It was used well into the 1200s as the Latin Bible for the Latin Bible believers, the Albigenses and Albigenses and the Waldenses. And it was a very good Bible. It very much matches our King James Bible. And what they wanted to do, what the Catholic Church wanted to do, was make it more Roman. Make it more Roman Catholic. So Jerome did that. He began work in 383, finished his work in 404 and 405, and that is now known as the Latin Vulgate. That is the official, really it was the official Roman Catholic Bible all through the Dark Ages. This is 400 AD. Some historians start the Dark Ages in 400 AD, running it through about 1500 AD. That was the year that Jerome turned the Old Latin into a Catholic New Testament Bible. You mess with God's book, brother, he'll turn the lights out on you. I'm telling you, if you don't believe it, he's going to personally turn the lights out on you. You're not going to get any light. And he does it for nations, too. But He thought Origen was the greatest teacher ever. And so this guy lives in a monastery for 35 years and basically is just responsible for corrupting the Bible for the Latin people so that the Roman Catholic Church had a Bible to mess people up on. He became a monk because, like I said, he was preoccupied with sex. And he had a dream. He had this dream that he found himself before Christ's judgment throne. And Christ scourged him because he had read a secular book. So literally, he says in his dream that Christ scourged him, so whipped him. And he whipped him so hard that the angels, Jerome said, came to his rescue and pulled Jesus off of him. Because Jesus kind of lost control. And that's his story. But that's what drove him to becoming a monk. Is that, you know, he needed to be purged and cleansed, and he learned his lesson, and he even swore that he still had actual marks from his dream. Now, it's supposed to be a dream, but he had actual marks on his back where Christ scourged him. See, he's crazy. That's what he is. In 374, he began spending long periods of time in the Syrian desert alone, starving with no clothing, battling his quote-unquote ravages of sensuality. He commended monastic life even against the will of the parents. He was all for basically kidnapping somebody, hauling them off to a monastery so that they could get close to God. He told one guy that he needed to go to the monastery and that if his mother, who bore him in her womb for 9 months, came to him crying that he should kick her and leave her. If his father laid across the threshold of the door, he should, on the way out the door, step on his father because they were both trying to keep him from doing Christ's work in becoming a flea-bitten monk. I'm telling you, this guy's nuts. He was an evangelistic celibate, so he pushed it hard, yet he also majored in gathering women, widows, and virgins around him and ministering to them. Now, there's no indication that, you know, what you think might happen, but it's funny because all these widows and women had money, and so he just gave. Now, if you don't know anybody else in history that did that, I'll tell you who else that did that. Muhammad. Muhammad always kept a woman around that had a bunch of money. Because he never did a bit of work in his life. In fact, here's something that somebody you know said. Jerome is one of the great doctored up doctors of the Roman Catholic Church. They canonized him. Jerome partook of the monastic life, highly recommended it to others. And in his entire lifetime, he was not caught once working for a living. He seemed destined from the start to an automatic subsistence provided for by the church or the monasteries or rich women with whom he consorted. He called a nun named Paula, who hung out with him some. Here it comes. You ready? The mother-in-law of God. Paula kissed a stone in Jerusalem that was supposed to have been the stone the angel rolled away from Christ's tomb. She disfigured her face to humble herself, tormented her body, and wept for hours at a time to atone for her, quote, sins of laughing. We are to presume, of course, according to Jerome, that if God had a mother-in-law, this would be how she would act. Anyway, it's laughable, but folks, this is serious history. Anyway, this guy was a argumentative and cruel when there's two guys mainly, a guy named Vigilantus and a guy named Jovinian. Both these guys are good guys. We don't know a lot about them, but they were against all the right stuff and for all the right stuff. But against Jovinian, these guys were arguing with Jerome about whether Mary should be worshipped and about whether infant baptism did anything or not. And of course, they held that it did not, that you shouldn't worship Mary. And so Jerome's response to Jovinian was that he was a savage howling of ferocious wolves scaring the flock. And then about Vigilantus, he said, Vigilantus, who, by the way, was against Mary worship, relic worship, clerical celibacy. Well, Jerome calls him a Jew. That's supposed to be a bad name. It was to him. I'm telling you, if you study it in Roman Catholicism, anti-Semitism is all through, all the way. Called him a Jew, a Samaritan, a madman, disgorging a filthy surfeit. He said Vigilantus' tongue was only fit to be cut out. That he had a fetid mouth fraught with putrid stench against the relics and ashes of the martyrs. By the way, that's a quote. He denounced him as a dog, a maniac, a monster, an ass, a fool, and a glutton. He was also the servant of the devil and a useless vessel which shall be shivered by the iron rod of apostolic authority. So I don't think Jerome liked Vigilantus. And it was all because Vigilantus said, if you worship Mary, it gets you absolutely nothing. So he just lit into him. So that's Jerome. Well, I've got to quit here. Have a few more things to say, but we'll get through the rest of what I have here pretty quick next time, and we'll get into some of the good guys. That's always a blessing. Any questions?